You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. The story of humankind is usually told as one of technological innovation and economic influence. Of arrowheads and atomic bombs, settlers and stock markets. But behind it all, there's an even more fundamental driver, food. In his new book, Animal Vegetable Junk, A History of Food from Sustainable to Suicidal, James Beard Award-winning food writer and number one best-selling author Mark Bittman offers a panoramic view of how the frenzy for food has driven human history to some of its most catastrophic moments, from slavery and colonialism to famine and genocide, and to our current moment wherein big food exacerbates climate change, plunders the planet, and sickens its people. And today, Mark Bittman joins me on the podcast to give a brief history of man's relationship with what we eat, and to point to activists, workers, and governments around the world who are choosing well-being over corporate greed and gluttony and fighting to free society from big food's grip. Mark reveals how he first got America to take food issues seriously and how we can rethink our food distribution systems and take a different approach to feeding the world's hungry. We discuss America's junk food epidemic and how to tell junk food from real food, how government farm subsidies actually incentivize the production of food with minimal to no nutritional value, and even the surprising ecological toll that junk food takes on the planet. Plus, Mark talks about his mostly vegan diet. He weighs in on the Impossible Burger, lab-grown meats, arsenic in the baby food, and his mixed feelings on President Biden's new appointment for Secretary of Agriculture. Coming up with food writer Mark Bittman in just a moment. Mark Bittman is the author of 30 books, including the How to Cook Everything series and the number one New York Times bestseller, VB6, Eat Vegan Before Six. He was a food journalist and columnist, opinion columnist, and the lead magazine food writer at the New York Times, where he started writing in 1984 and stayed for 30 years. He has received 6 James Beard Awards, and his 2007 TED Talk, What's Wrong with What We Eat, has almost 5 million views. Bittman is currently special advisor on food policy at Columbia University's Mailman School of Public Health, where he teaches and hosts a lecture series called Food, Public Health, and Social Justice. He's also the founder and the editor-in-chief of the Bittman Project, and now he's out with a monumental book addressing all manner of food issues. It's called Animal Vegetable Junk, A History of Food from Sustainable to Suicidal. Mark Bittman, welcome to the podcast.
Nice to be here, Ben. Thank you for using the word monumental. That's great.
Well, first time I've heard that. Well, it really is. I mean, it is an all-encompassing look at the history of food and all manner of food issues. I mean, it really covers everything. How long did it take to come up with this? I mean, I guess in some sense, you've been writing on these issues for many years, huh?
I mean, you talk to authors all the time, you know, it's you could say that it took me 3 years or you could say that it took me 30. I just found a book proposal for something very much like Animal Vegetable Junk that I had written 10 years ago and forgotten about. So you know, who knows? I mean, I've been thinking along these lines for a long time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I also kind of want to hear about your career trajectory, because as I recall, I think you started out as a political writer, correct? Yes, you weren't initially a food writer. How did that come about?
I was a student radical in the late 60s, early 70s. I graduated college, became a cab driver and a community organizer. And because I was actually a terrible community organizer, because I have like social dread. I don't really like confronting strangers and telling them why they should believe the way I do. I was put in charge of the newspaper. So I was running a small newspaper for a community organizing group. And I learned, you know, it was like graduate school for me. I learned a lot. I learned not only how to edit other people's work, but edit my own better. I learned how to type, which is a very important skill for a journalist, I think. I learned how to do layout and all that kind of stuff. And then I became a freelancer, and eventually the things that people were interested in when I was writing were more often about food than not. Mm-hmm. And that was 40 years ago. And that's how it's been pretty much since then.
Yeah, you were a food writer at the Times for many, many years, but you've also been instrumental in elevating the discussion of food as this larger issue involving the environment, economics, social justice and matters of fairness, public health, agribusiness, and even our distribution systems for food. When you first started writing about these issues around food, did you encounter a lot of pushback from the Times in terms of getting people to take food seriously?
I mean, the short answer is yes. I mean, thank you for saying all of that, because that was the goal. I think that I was, because I was political early on, I think that when I was doing just recipes and travel and so on, I had a little bit of trouble justifying that to myself, because I thought I wanted to tackle bigger issues, but I didn't see a way in really. Until 1999, 2000, I saw the writing on the wall. I saw that humans couldn't be consuming meat at the rate Americans did, and that our diet was leading us into worse and worse places. I became interested in agriculture, which is, after all, a really important part of food. Yeah. You write about that for the Times, and yes, there was some pushback. Because I was in the food section, and the food section was seen as a place where food was to be written about in a joyous, loving, happy manner, spend money and have a great time. And I wanted to write about the intersection of climate, raising animals, diet, nutrition, and health. And finally, I convinced the right people at the Times to let me do that, but it wasn't for the food section. And eventually I wound up writing for both the magazine and the opinion sections, and that was a really great gig, and raised all the issues you talked about before and then some. And I love doing that, but it didn't. Weekly columns are not the same as books. I mean, that goes without saying, but I sort of thought, oh, I'll tell this story a little bit at a time. I'll write 800, 1,000, 1,200 words a week, and people will follow me and they'll understand what I'm trying to say. But it doesn't work that way. A book is, ultimately, I realized I have to write a book about this. I need everything that I'm thinking, mm-hmm. or much of what I'm thinking, in one place at one time. And that's what became Animal Vegetable Junk.
Yeah, this book really is epic in its scope. One of the most fascinating aspects of it is you walk us through the history of humans' relationship with food. I feel like I'm asking you to do some real heavy lifting here, but could you give us a brief, I mean, you've truncated it about as much as you probably can in the book, but could you give us a brief sketch of how that has played out over the millennia?
The book is, I think, 300 pages. I could have written for 20 years. I mean, it could have been six volumes. Sure. It would have been easy, but not easy. But anyway, the short version, let's see. food-shaped humans. We know that. Many people argue that until there was fire and cooking, we weren't really human. When we learned how to do agriculture, it really changed things. And that was about 10,000 years ago. That's what started civilizations. That's also what started hierarchical societies. You can argue that it started gender bias at some point also, but
interesting.
You asked to keep it short. So fast forward, well, say 80, 9,500 years, fast forward to the 15th century. And you have a situation in which Europeans were running out of food. They were running out of land and they were running out of food. And the Europeans were really forced, especially the Europeans in the smaller countries with very strict borders in the western part of the continent, were forced to start looking for more land. And when they found the Americas, I mean, one could only imagine they couldn't believe their luck. Fast forward again 200 or 300 years through the migration of sugar from Asia to North and South America, the migration of slavery from Europe to the United States. And what you had was a wealthy land that was ripe for what became industrial agriculture, the transition of growing food for ourselves, our family, our neighbors, our region, to growing food for money. Mm-hmm. The development of capitalism and the cash society and the agriculture that served that, which is agriculture in which the primary goal is how much money can we make in growing this crop? And that is really, if you have to look for a kind of seed of where things really went wrong, I mean, there are a bunch of turning points, but where things really go wrong is instead of saying, how can we grow nutritious food that's affordable to everybody in the country or the world, we start saying, how can those of us who own the food system, own land, own processing, own distribution, how can we grow as much stuff as we can to convert into things that we can sell for as much profit as possible? That's, you know, this is not really the difference between altruism and cruelty. It's the difference between how you look at what food is for, how you answer the question, what food is for. And if you think food is for making money, you're going to wind up with a really different food system than if you think food is for, let's say, promoting health and well-being. Mm-hmm.
Now, I think it was Jared Diamond who said that agriculture is the worst invention ever made.
Yep. The biggest mistake in the haste, in the right. history of the human race, he
right.
called it.
You seem to kind of make the case for him in this book because you point out how food has led to war and slavery and colonialism. In fact, you know, I think in my mind, I tend to think of European colonialism as being more about natural resources and mineral resources, gold and lumber and that sort of thing. But I don't think that there's as much conversation about the fact that British and Dutch and French colonialism in Asia and Africa and South America was also about tea and sugar and all kinds of these food crops.
Well, and land. I mean, land for animals to graze, land to raise crops, and absolutely luxury goods, for sure. You know, there's no going back. We can't fix what's happened. We can only look forward. So you can make this very fun argument, and I get into it a little bit, that agriculture was a huge mistake. And you can reveal this, I think, fascinating history of how food has helped shaped humanity, where we are right now. But the real questions are, what does it look like at the moment, and how do we move forward, and how do we move forward in a positive way? And the book is kind of divided into those sections, how we got here, where we are, and where we're going.
Well, yeah, let's talk about where we are. You talk about addressing food as a public health crisis in this book, and you say in here, amazingly, that over 60% of the food that we consume is junk food. Now, how do you define junk food? What is that?
Well, is it the old, was it that Supreme Court decision about pornography?
Oh, right.
I can't say what it is, but I know it when I see it.
Right.
I mean, we all know what junk food is when we see it. It's not... all food is processed, but the question is when is it processed beyond recognition as food? So you can say it's got more than five ingredients. You can say your grandmother or your great-grandmother wouldn't recognize it as food. You can say it contains ingredients that you've never heard of. You can say it contains ingredients that would never be in your kitchen or you wouldn't know what to do with if they were, you could say it's all of those things. But really, we know what junk food is. And that 60% statistic, that the 60% of calories sold in the United States are ultra-processed food or junk food, that's an important statistic because it means that 60% of what we eat is non-nutritious. If you look up the definition of food in the dictionary, it says it's a substance that supports nutrition. That begs the question, what's nutrition? So you look up nutrition and it says a substance that supports health. Well, this food, so-called food, doesn't support health. It supports the opposite of health, which makes it closer in definition to poison than it does to food. And if 60% of our calories as a society are closer to poison than to food, no wonder we have a public health crisis.
Yeah. I mean, where do you draw the line in terms of what's junk and what's not? Because, you know, there are processed foods that might to some people seem like something natural, like Wonder Bread. I mean, is that junk food?
Yeah, for sure. There's a way in which the degree of processing is important. So you can look at an apple, you can look at applesauce, and you can look at apple juice. And
okay.
And no one's going to argue that an apple isn't good for you. But people who understand endocrinology, the digestive system, and so on will argue that apple juice is bad for you. So is apple juice junk food? I don't know. Sort of. Is Coca-Cola junk food? Yeah, we get that. Are they roughly equivalent? Well, they kind of are. I mean, so apple juice comes from natural products, but it's so highly processed that your body treats it pretty much the way that it treats Coca-Cola. Mm-hmm. And similarly, your body treats white bread pretty much the same way as it treats a sugar cookie. So we could go on. The whole notion of making food palatable, sweet, exciting has also been a marketing ploy for selling food, in which we've turned breakfast into dessert. We've turned lunch into fast food made of mushy stuff that is really not good for us. And we've turned dinner into taco night, pizza night, and so on. And, you know, so little of this stuff has any relationship to the food that's grown in soil, tended, cared for, and you know, really doesn't need a label. I mean, real food doesn't need labeling because real food, we know what an orange is. We know what a piece of meat is.
Now, in terms of getting us to eat better, is this something that needs to come from the government and regulation, or is it more a case of consumers voting with their forks and big food responding to that segment of the market that at least more recently seems to be demanding less sugar, more whole grains, and so on?
You know, I think it's both. Our food preferences are shaped when we're young. And very young. I mean, there's even evidence that food preferences begin to be shaped in utero. But let's just say that by the time you're 4 or 6, your food preferences are pretty, and we all know that because we, especially in the COVID era, we all know the food that we've retreated to when we're feeling bad or frightened or upset in any way. Oh, yeah. And it is the food that we learn to love as kids. So to move away from that diet is a very challenging thing. And anyone over the age of 20 can attest to that. Everybody knows what a good diet is. If I say what's a good diet, the image that forms in most people's heads is less junk food, more plants, fruits and vegetables, and so on, fewer animal products, way less sugar. Everybody sort of thinks along, but that's not what your habits tell you. That's not what food marketing tells you. And it's not what your preferences born in childhood tell you. So how do we get away from that? So yes, some of us have the abilities to change the way that we eat. Not everybody does. Some of us have the ability to change the way that we eat, and we can change our buying habits and we can influence what's sold to some extent. But not everybody does have those. And I like to say, if we want a generation of healthy 40-year-olds, we have to raise a generation of healthy 4-year-olds. We have to start teaching children what good food is and feeding them good food in schools and at home, but I think especially in schools, because we can do it there. I mean, maybe scientifically is not the right word, but we can do it rationally in schools, whereas we can say, this is what a good diet is. This is what a good school lunch would look like. And we can work towards that. It's harder for individual parents to do that. Yeah. So we do need, as with so many of our big issues, we do need government involvement here. We need regulations around marketing junk food to children, or we need regulations around school lunches. We need to look very carefully about how we're raising animals, how many we're raising, and what the environmental impact is. We need to look at pesticides and other poisons in the environment. There's just so many things that individuals can't do.
We're going to take a quick break, and then we'll return with more when we come back in just a moment. I wonder how much of the problem with this abundance of junk food is a direct result of farm subsidies. I mean, we're paying farmers to overproduce corn, but there's only so much corn we can eat or put into our cars. So we have Twinkies and sodas and all this other stuff.
I mean, you're exactly right. So then to go back to your other question, how do consumers affect that? Sure, we can eat fewer Twinkies. But the real question is, look, growing food for millions of people, hundreds of millions of people, billions of people, that's not an easy thing to do. No. And it costs money, it takes energy, it takes people, it takes land, obviously, water. This is not a simple thing. We have chosen to subsidize, we have chosen to support a kind of agriculture that produces food that's not good for us and it's not good for the land. Corn is a perfect example, obviously. How do we shift those subsidies to saying we want to grow food that's good for people? We want to grow food that doesn't destroy the land. We want to grow food that doesn't require so many pesticides that I don't know. I think we've used a pound of DDT in the 50s. I think we used a pound of DDT for every person on Earth. And that kind of thing continues. How do we make that transition? And I think the answer is little by little, but I think we have to have some kind of vision of where we want things to go. And it goes back to the question of what's food for? Are we growing corn so we can make ethanol? Because that's just the silliest thing. Ethanol's not even a particularly efficient fuel. Right. So it's just like, it's a direct subsidy of corn farmers. What's the point? How is that doing anyone other than the corn farmers any good?
And it's interesting that we don't subsidize fresh fruits or vegetables. We're subsidizing grains and soy, which can be stored for months and months and months. You know, it seems to me that we should be subsidizing these healthy alternatives like fruits and vegetables, which actually have a spoilage factor. So there is an urgency. They probably need subsidy more than anyone.
Well, good point. I mean, you know, there's nothing intrinsically wrong with corn and soybeans. Soybeans especially are super healthy food. We don't eat soybeans. We don't eat edamame in any quantity. We eat chicken McNuggets, which are chickens that have been fed corn and soy, breaded with corn and fried in soy. I mean, it's a perfect storm in a way of disastrous foodstuff. So, you know, what we subsidize determines what we grow. What we grow determines what we eat. Mm-hmm. It does come full circle, and we have to. There's nothing wrong with growing grains. The problem is that corn and soy and wheat and rice in their whole form actually do spoil. And that's what in the 19th and 20th centuries, what happened was ways were found to strip those grains. They're called grains, even though they're not all grains, to strip those grains of the things that made them spoil. And that's how you got mass production of white flour, for example. Or white rice, neither of which is anywhere near as good for you as brown flour or brown rice, but both of which will keep forever. So that was sort of the thing. It's like, how do we take wheat and turn it into a form that we can store, not for months, for years? Mm-hmm. And the answer was take away the bran and take away the germ. Well, that's where the nutrients are. Yeah. So you've turned wheat, which is a perfectly healthy food, into something that does nobody any good except for the people who grow it and process it.
Well, speaking more about the government end of things, Tom Vilsack is now returning to the post that he held during the Obama administration as Secretary of Agriculture. I think a lot of people had high hopes that he would have done more on the regulatory side in his first tour of duty, so to speak. Were you disappointed, and are you optimistic that things might be different this time around?
Great question, Ben. I was one of those. I started writing my opinion column very shortly after Obama was elected. And the argument then was, there's some low-hanging fruit here. There's some things that a Secretary of Agriculture and a Secretary of the FDA and the President can do. Don't even require the approval of Congress. We can really make the food system better. For example, taking antibiotics out of the routinely administered feed of industrially produced animals. You can make antibiotics so that they're only used when an animal is sick, and you can do that by edict, and you can do it easily. The Obama administration, Vilsack, did it more as a voluntary system for food producers. So, of course, if you make something voluntary in the business world, it doesn't happen. So, yes, they were disappointing. Vilsack, in many ways, was disappointing in many, many ways. And a lot of us had higher hopes for Biden's pick and were disappointed when Vilsack was nominated again. He has sent out better signals, to the extent where some people are calling him Vilsack the second. So he has made noise about doing things better in the food system. And I, you know, he's going to be the Secretary of Agriculture. We've got to give him some time to see if he is going to do things better than he did the first time around. We have to hold his feet to the fire to make sure he does. It's too early to say we hate his guts, that's for sure.
Right. I've heard your name before, and I've seen some of your articles, but I think the first time that I really became aware of you was a few years ago when I actually last time I spoke with Anthony Bourdain about his documentary Wasted. And one of the interesting statistics that I got from that just floored me was that more than 30% of crops are wasted. They either don't make to the grocery shelves for various reasons, whether they're not visually appealing, or in a lot of cases, we only use a very small percentage of the actual plant. It makes me think of Brussels sprouts. We take the sprouts and then we throw out the stalks. How do we address that? What's the secret to getting farmers to lower that percentage? Or is it more on the consumer end? Is it a matter of, you know, Mark Bittman needs to make a cookbook about how to use the parts of vegetables that we don't use, and meats as well?
There are a couple of good cookbooks like that, actually. You know, I was in that documentary and I told them I was going to have a different attitude about food waste than anybody else they talked to. And I do. I'd like to say this. A third of the corn grown in Iowa is used for ethanol. A third of the corn grown in Iowa is used as animal feed in an animal product production system that is wrong from start to finish. Mm-hmm. And a third of the corn grown in Iowa is used to make junk food. Iowa's the second most productive agricultural state after California, and all of its corn is going into products that I consider wasteful. So when you want to start talking about food waste, let's talk about land waste first and what we're planting. Because if that all of Iowa were planted in Brussels sprouts and you threw away all the stalks, you'd still be in way better shape than you are now. So it's not
interesting.
This is not the consumer's fault. This is not about what's being dropped off the truck or left to rot in the fields. Agriculture, as I said, is hard. Producing food is hard. Yes, people overbuy. Yes, people don't finish what's on their plate. All of that could be addressed and so on. But the question is, what are we planting? Is what we're planting good for us and good for the environment? And the answer is often no. I don't know how you could find anything more wasteful than that situation.
Yeah. What do you say to a lot of people who say that these issues, they're really first world problems? The U.S. has the luxury of thinking about the environment and healthy eating and things like locally sourced ingredients and organics. But for much of the rest of the world, they're just concerned with getting food in their bellies.
Well, 1 billion people are hungry. And it's a lower percentage than it's been in a long time. And it's actually 800 million. 1 billion is a roundup. So, yes, people are concerned about getting food into their bellies, but over 2 billion people are malnourished in the sense that they're eating calories that aren't good for them. So the United States is not the only country in the world that has problems with diet, but we are the source, in a way, of bad diet. We've exported the American style of agriculture and the American style of eating, first to Western Europe, then to Mexico, Central and South America, now increasingly to Asia, because we are in the, for better or worse, enviable position of being world cultural leaders. What we do matters in many ways, but also as world economic leaders, we're able to force our will. I'm not talking about you and me, but our corporations, American corporations, or let's say multinational corporations, have exported this style of agriculture and this style of eating to the rest of the world and basically said, if you want to be a part of the world economic community, you need to be doing agriculture the way we're doing agriculture. And that means buy big machines, use hybridized seeds, use pesticides, do monoculture, enter the world of growing crops for sale to make money, and then there's this theory, you know, it's a neoliberal theory. I'm sure you've talked about it with people who know way more about it than I do, but there is this theory that everybody should be producing what they produce best. Mm-hmm. And yet, if you make it so that Mexicans are forced to buy American corn, you put Mexican farmers out of work. And what are the, you're not creating work for those Mexican farmers. So all you've done is succeeded in destroying a way of life mm-hmm. on the altar of cheap corn. And that doesn't make any sense.
And a lot of this goes to the global food distribution systems that we have. And the pandemic has really exposed dangerous insufficiencies in those systems. How do we resolve those?
Well, the argument is that we resolve them by relying more heavily on regionally produced food. And rather than creating an international economic food system, again, one where maybe the United States, Brazil, and Russia supply the majority of corn and soybeans, support people in growing what grows well on their land, what their traditional foods are, what feeds their people, and create a robust regional food system and a robust regional economy that can survive stresses like COVID and like climate change, which is affecting agriculture already and will do more and more of that as the years go by.
And on the environmental front, a little while ago, I had Chef Magnus Nilsson on, the chef from Faviken in Sweden, and he is Mr. Sustainability, who is one of the pioneers of locally grown ingredients and so on. He actually said that sustainability in the restaurant business is a myth. It's a lie. Do you understand what he's getting at? And do you agree?
I if he's doing everything, no, I don't. Okay. I mean, I think here's the thing about restaurants. They either have to be expensive, or they have to exploit labor, or they have to use crummy ingredients, or they have to pay no rent. If they can't do one of those four things, they go out of business. So it's, you know, it's not my specialty, but it's not a world I particularly am expert in at this point.
Right. You mostly cook for yourself, right?
Yeah, well,
I mean, even before the pandemic, when was the last time you went into a restaurant?
No, I mean, I like restaurants, but and I used to write about them quite a bit, but more and more, I think I'm enjoying being at home. I'm enjoying cooking for myself. I recommend other people do that too, but that part of my work has really fallen by the wayside.
Dealing with all of these serious issues around food, is food still a joyous subject for you and something, a pursuit that you like?
Yeah, absolutely. I still love to cook. You know, there's a kind of feeling that if you're lucky enough to get good ingredients and you know what to do with them, then you eat as well as anybody possibly can. And from that perspective, we live in a fabulous time. I mean, those of us who are privileged enough to be able to get our hands on good ingredients, there's a wider variety than there's ever been, and they're as good as they've been. So,
yeah,
it's a great time to cook. It's just not a great time food-wise for everybody. And
right.
And true, that's a big question. How is that going to happen?
And I mentioned your number one best-selling book, Eat Vegan Before Six. Are you still mostly keeping a vegan diet these days?
you know, it was never, the idea was never for it to be a vegan diet. The idea was for it to be a set of rules that got me to eat more plants. So vegan before six, or VB6, as we call it, was really a set of rules that said, eat like a crazy, strict, maniacal vegan from the time you wake up until six at night, and then do whatever you want. And that was pretty much what I did and do. I try to eat really strictly during the day, and then at night, I eat whatever I want. And that's worked for me. But really, any set of rules that people can create to get themselves eating more plants is a good set of rules.
I want to ask you about some of the new innovations in that area, specifically things like the Impossible Burger. Now, that is, of course, a processed product. Is that a net positive or a net negative in your mind?
I think it's zero sum. Is that what it is? Okay. But it's neither positive nor negative. Okay. Look, anything that reduces animal suffering, it's fine with me. And but it is ultra processed food. It's not necessarily better for you than many, many, many plant-based alternatives. And it actually isn't, it's not even clear that it's reducing the consumption of animal products. So when we get to a place when we have a meat substitute that doesn't use more resources than necessary, is actually good for you, reduces animal suffering, reduces consumption of animal products, I'll be supportive of that, but I don't think we're there yet. I mean, I said before, and I'll say this again, you know, rice and beans, or let's say legumes and whole grains in combination is sort of the healthiest simple food in the world. And you can make a burger out of grains and legumes if you want to, or you can eat a bowl of rice and beans, whatever you like. But there are really, really simple to make, cheap, easy to produce legume and grain combinations that have supported millions of people and continue to support even billions of people right now. We don't need to reinvent food. We need to look at ways we can sustainably produce real food and feed that to people.
Do you consider lab-grown meat real food?
I'll let you know when I see it and we get to have a real look at it. I mean, right now it's completely experimental.
Okay. I kind of feel like it's similar to artificial insemination. There was a time when everyone used to call artificial insemination test tube babies, if it was something freaky. And now over the years, it's become very much accepted. I almost wonder if that's going to be a similar process with lab-grown meat.
You know, I think we humans do come to accept things if they make sense. So we'll have to see if it makes sense.
And now, of course, we have to worry about arsenic in baby food, of all things. As a parent, that's no picnic.
Yeah.
You know, in this case, the problem is the result of what's in the soil. It's not necessarily something that big food is deliberately adding to food. How do we deal with that? What's the solution there?
Well, the safest, I mean, obviously, if there's an endemic, a widespread poisoning of the soil, then it's an FDA job to clean up that soil. But I think on an individual basis, the best way to guarantee that there are no or at least fewer chemicals in your food is to buy organic food. And you know, there's a kind of hierarchy of decisions. It's not that complicated, but it bothers people. And I understand that. But, you know, the recommendation is a good diet is pretty simple. It's more plants, it's less junk food, it's fewer animal products. It's kind of as simple as that. But then there are these questions of fair labor practices, organic, pesticides, and so on. And it's hard to evaluate all that stuff. And we don't often have all the information we need to make those decisions intelligently. So it goes back to, are these matters of individual choice? No, these are matters of regulation, of making the right laws, of enforcing laws that are existing, of using government or supporting government that protects its citizens, which is what government was supposed to be for in the first place.
Right. But this is a similar conversation that I had with the former FDA commissioner, David Kessler, a few months back. I mean, can we really rely on the information on those food labels?
What did he say? Not to turn the question around. I respect David Kessler enormously.
He said a lot of times no. But it almost sounds from earlier in our conversation that you would say that people should just go toward food that don't need to have labels.
Well, I mean, if you're eating an orange, and it's the second time I brought up oranges, but I'm staring at a bowl, so it's not okay. Surprising. If you're eating an orange, it doesn't need a label. Was it grown in soil with arsenic? That's a question. Can you find that out? Well, you can't find it out if it comes from halfway around the world. So this is a further argument for supporting a regional food system where you actually can find out where your food comes from.
Okay.
If you know your farmer, you know, it's an old saying, know your farmer, know your food. If you know your farmer, if you know where your food is coming from, you have a much better chance of figuring out what's in that food and how good it is for you.
Well, real quickly before we go, I also want to plug the Bittman Project. This is something new that you've been working on. Tell us a little about that.
Thanks, Ben. We have a newsletter that's currently three times a week and moving towards four, and it's covering all aspects of food, everything from cooking to the kind of stuff that we're talking about. And it's called the Bittman Project. There are a bunch of people involved, and you can find it at the Bittman Project or at markbittman.com.
Terrific. And once again, the book is called Animal Vegetable Junk, A History of Food from Sustainable to Suicidal. Mark Bittman, thanks for talking with me.
It's really fun, Ben. Thank you very much.
Thanks again to Mark Bittman for coming on the show. Order his new book, Animal Vegetable Junk, A History of Food from Sustainable to Suicidal, on Amazon, Audible, or wherever books are sold. Subscribe to his newsletter, The Bittman Project, at bittmanproject.com, and keep up with him at markbittman.com and on Twitter at @bittman. If you enjoyed today's podcast, be sure to subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts and rate and review us while you're there. 5-star ratings and detailed reviews are one of the best ways for new listeners to discover the show. You can also follow us on Facebook or on Twitter at @KickAssNewsPod and recommend us to your friends on your social media. For more fun stuff, visit kickassnews.com, and I welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions at comments@kickassnews.com. For now, I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass News.